Good morning. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz, in for Kate Archer-Kent. Five people died as a result of the mob attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. One was a Capitol Police officer who was beaten by rioters. Four were supporters of President Trump who had come to the nation's capital to see their president and be part of a movement. One was shot by police. One was crushed by a swarm of people. One died of a heart attack, the other of a stroke while at a rally. 140 police officers were injured. Vice President Mike Pence was whisked away to safety moments before the mob arrived. Members of Congress hid in their office and in tunnels under the building, donning gas masks. According to Reuters, taxpayers will be on the hook for the damages. It was for these events that President Donald Trump was impeached by the U.S. House of Representatives. Now he stands trial in the Senate, where Democrats face an uphill battle to convince their Republican colleagues to join them in convicting the former president. Today is day four of what looks like it will be the quickest impeachment trial in history. What do you think happens next? You can join us at 800-642-1234. Or email at ideas@wpr.org. To learn what's in store for today's trial, we turn to Anita Kumar. Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent and associate editor at Politica. Good morning, Anita.
Thanks for having me.
Glad you could join us this morning. Well, the Democratic House impeachment managers, they made their final arguments to lawmakers yesterday. What were some of the takeaways that stood out to you?
Well, again, thanks for having me. Yes, you're right. It is going very fast here. We expect it to be done pretty soon. You know, the Democrats laid out an argument that it basically showed what was happening in the Capitol that day, and they showed what President Trump was doing and saying that day. And so sort of what came out of that is, you know, we've all seen that video footage. But because they sort of put it together, you knew what President Trump was doing at the time. So even when he knew what was happening at the Capitol, he continued to tweet. Of particular importance, I think, is a tweet that he sent out about his vice president. So if you'll recall that day, he was criticizing Vice President Pence for not trying to stop the proceedings, not trying to overturn the election that Donald Trump and Mike Pence lost. And so he was still tweeting about that and talking about that and talking about that at the White House when rioters had already stormed the Capitol. And I think that was one of the key things that came out of what we saw in the last few days, is that President Trump continued to do this. That a lot of the rioters and protesters said that they took their cue from what President Trump was doing. They talked about his tweets. They said them out loud outside. And so, you know, they're trying to paint the picture that what President Trump did that day and the previous 2 months when he, you know, tried to overturn the election was the cue for these protesters to storm the Capitol.
And now what we heard opening arguments a few days ago from both sides, and we'll hear from Trump's defense team today. What defense do you think he will put up?
Well, they've really been arguing two things. One, and we heard this from them the very first day, which is that this proceeding is not constitutional. They say that the president needs to still be in office for this proceeding to be constitutional. Now, there was a vote that very first day, and a majority of senators said that the proceeding could go on, that the proceeding was constitutional. So that is already telling us that the Senate doesn't agree with President Trump's team on that. So they are likely to look towards the second argument, which is that the president, the former president now, had the free speech right to say what he said that day. So it was the First Amendment right to have to speak to this crowd, to the protesters, and he could say what he wanted to say. Now, what you'll hear the Democrats say is, well, it wasn't just about January 6th. He had been, sort of pushing protesters to do this for the 2 months before when he wouldn't agree to the election, to the results of the election. And, you know, that he was signaling to them to do something what ended up happening, which is trespass and vandalize and obviously cause harm to people. So they're saying, well, yes, people do have a free speech right to talk. but not to the point that it causes a crime or violence.
And you mentioned the video evidence that Democrats presented. I noticed that our own congressman here in Wisconsin, Mike Gallagher, came up in the trial. You know, he had posted that video online from his office during the riot, asking the president to call off his supporters. And Democrats used this to say, hey, members of Congress believed Trump was calling the shots that day. Was that persuasive to the Senate?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I do think that if you had to take sort of one thing away from this week so far on the trial, it was that gripping footage on Wednesday that we saw. New footage. We had not seen some of that footage, and members of Congress, senators, had not seen some of that footage. So what that really showed was how close a number of senators had gotten to, you know, the mob catching up to them. You know, we saw the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. We saw Senator Mitt Romney from Utah just minutes before the mob, you know, catches up or tries to catch up to them. You know, them turning around and trying to run another way, literally running. So I think that from my colleagues that were present in the chamber and seeing the senators right outside that day, it really struck them. I mean, they put, you know, their hands over their eyes and they nodded their heads, and they were visibly shaken by some of that video. And that's probably the one thing that they're really going to take from this week so far.
Do you think it's changing minds?
I don't. And the reason is that, again, senators have spoken during the breaks. They've been asked questions by reporters, and it's clear from the Republicans that they haven't really changed their minds. And an important thing to note is that they did take that vote on the very first day. And that vote, again, was to say whether they felt like this proceeding should go forward. And only 6 Republicans thought this proceeding, this actual trial, was constitutional. It's very hard for someone to say, well, I don't think this trial is constitutional, but I'm going to vote to convict this man. Why would you convict if you don't think this whole proceeding is constitutional? And so the bar is very high here. I do think that they're all very moved. You can tell that from their visible, you know, how they look and what they say. They're reliving that day. You know, they were all there hiding in the Capitol and worried and scared. But that does not mean that they're saying President Trump was at fault.
And so given that while this is a trial, it's a political trial. It's not the same as a trial in a typical court of law. What do you think the Democrats' goals are here?
Well, I think the Democrats went in knowing that the bar was really high. And just to give people a sense, of course, the number is, of course, the Senate is 50-50 now, so 50 Republicans, 50 Democrats. 17 Republicans would have to vote with Democrats to convict because it's a supermajority. It's not just 51 here.
Right,
so that's quite a lot of people. I think they went in knowing that it's going to be very, very unlikely that he would be convicted, but that they wanted to send a message to the country, to future presidents and other politicians, and really to the world, that if you take actions like this, that you're going to be held accountable. And so I think a lot of it was the message that they wanted to send, that this could not happen again. And even though they knew it was unlikely to go further than that, they felt it was important to show that he was accountable in some fashion. And I think they think that's what they're doing. And I will say from President Trump's side, you know, even if he's not convicted, which he's not likely to be, you know, January 6th changed things for him. I don't know that he would have actually run for president again in 2024. He had been sort of cooling to the idea the previous 2 months before January 6th. But his reputation and his legacy, it's more than tarnished. You know, his political future, there may not be one now because of what happened January 6th. So there are repercussions to what happened.
We're speaking with Anita Kumar, a White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. What's in store for today's impeachment trial? We're getting a briefing from Anita Kumar. She is a White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. How do you see this trial? Do you think there will be potential for more violence at the Capitol? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. Anita, one of the arguments that has been made at the trial is that there is this likelihood of more violence, that there's still anger among certain parts of the population. Do you see the Senate giving that argument much credence?
Well, I do think that everything feels a little bit different since January 6th. If you've been over near the Capitol or the White House, there's just so much more security than there ever has been. And during the trial, the National Guard is still on patrol around the Capitol complex. So, the senators can feel that and see that, as they're going to work every day. I think police have said, or law enforcement have said, that there hasn't been anything particular this week that they thought was coming up, but that there are protests and other events planned for after the trial, later in the year, even March, I heard, which is, getting several months past the election. So I do think they're thinking about that, but I don't think it's the forefront of whether President Trump, incited this riot on January 6th. They are trying to look backwards at that, sort of what were his actions, and did he incite these people? Remember, nothing he said out and out said it. He didn't say, storm the Capitol and harm people and kill people. But what the Democrats are arguing is what he said was enough, that he did push them to go fight, and he had been pushing them for 2 months.
So why, another question that I've wondered, why are we not hearing from witnesses in this trial?
It's a great question. And it's actually one of the most unusual things I think about this. I think that's partly because Republicans and Democrats want this to go fast, and it goes faster without witnesses. So, Democrats are eager to get back to President Biden's agenda. They have a lot to do, including coronavirus relief legislation that hasn't been agreed to yet. And Republicans obviously just want to not talk about President Trump anymore. They want to get on with it. So witnesses would sort of bog that down. It's also different than President Trump's first impeachment trial. This is something that, the senators have already experienced. They experienced firsthand. So they are the witnesses a little bit. They could hear from other people, but they lived it that day where they were hiding in offices and behind chairs and under desks. They are also getting, I think, what they want from these videos. They are seeing, instead of having witnesses, they're seeing these videos that are sort of taking the place of that. But I do think one of the reasons is they want to make this as short as possible.
And what do you make of President Biden's remarks that he's not really watching the trial?
Well, I do think that they're trying to convey, and they are trying to sort of move on from this. I mean, in a certain way, President Biden couldn't, he's obviously president, he's obviously been working, but this has been hanging over him and Washington for weeks now. And I think that once it's over, it'll feel a little bit different here and probably a little bit different for those in the White House. But they do want to convey that they're working and doing other things. There's really nothing they can do about this. It's proceeding. I guess President Biden could have said to the Democrats, look, you shouldn't do this impeachment trial. But remember, again, these people lived this day, and they very much felt like President Trump should be accountable. So he's moving on with it. The one thing I will say, though, is, he's doing events. The White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, is doing briefings all this week while this is going on. And Washington's attention, anyway, is fully on the impeachment trial. So they're not getting the attention that they did the previous week. And you can sort of tell that because, as one example, the TV networks, CNN and MSNBC, they're playing the impeachment trial. They're not playing what is happening at the White House. And it does feel like all the attention is on on the trial, but that will, you know, obviously dissipate next week.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Anita Kumar of Politico and taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to the phones. We have Bob in Chippewa Falls with us. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I think your guest is right. It's become a political trial. And I think if you go back to Trump's boast back in the campaign of 2016, I can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and my voters will still vote for me. Update that. I can incite a group to mob mentality, send them toward Congress, and the Senate Republicans aren't going to vote me out. They won't vote against me. And that's about as arrogant as it gets. It's really sad view on the Senate.
Thanks.
They really are a bunch of pups.
Thanks, Bob. Anita Kumar, what do you see the Senate taking away from this? How is this changing political dynamics in Washington?
Well, I think it's hard. You know, it's always hard for them, Democrats and Republicans, to work together. You know, and it's gotten harder over the years, partly because of President Trump and also unrelated to President Trump. It just gets more partisan year after year. So I do think, you know, it's going to be tough for them after this to say, OK, well, let's sit down and negotiate a bill. But, you know, they know that they are going to have to do that, that this is going to end in the next few days and they're going to have to move on to, you know, all the other things that they want to do. Tackle the coronavirus and deal with infrastructure and immigration, and they know that they're going to have to sit down and do it. I think what's really difficult right now with the Senate is it's only 50-50. I mean, it couldn't be closer, obviously. You know, Democrats have the majority because the vice president is a Democrat and she can break ties, but they really do have to work together. 50-50 means that they have to work together. Nothing can get through unless they've all sort of really sat down and talked about it, and I think they know that going forward that's how it's going to be.
But is there trust to work together? I mean, you've mentioned that the heightened security, we've seen the metal detectors, we've seen the headlines about some members not wanting to use them. How do they move forward?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. I think one of the things that has struck me the most over these last few weeks, or, you know, this year, I guess, is that the House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, said a couple weeks ago this really unbelievable line at a press conference that she said, you know, the enemy is within. She meant within the House. So her point there was, you know, people, Republicans or some Republicans, you know, she felt were the enemy, the against them or trying to hurt them. And, you know, I mentioned this is the House. Of course, the Senate's the same way, right? I mean, there is really very little trust among some members, not all, but some members. And that's going to make things very, very difficult. You know, also on the House side, the Speaker of the House has been really critical of the House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, who, you know, if you'll recall, at one point did say President Trump was responsible for this and then backed off of that. He said everybody was responsible. He flew down to Florida to see President Trump. So there is a lot of distrust, and it's going to make it very difficult for them to move forward and try to get anything passed. But I do think that they realize that they've got to try to do that.
Well, let's sneak in one last caller this hour. We're going to go to Jim in Freedom. Good morning, Jim.
Yes, I think personally all the lawmakers need to take responsibility for what happened. All summer long, we saw rioting and stuff going on all over the country. And did any of these lawmakers on the other side condemn any of that? No. They actually have a recording of one lawmaker said they should be rioting. And are we going after that lawmaker? We should be. If you're going to go after Trump for what he did, and I think what he did was wrong. He did encourage people. I didn't vote for the guy. But if we're going to go after him for this, we have to go after all the other lawmakers that sat on their hands and did nothing, because they rubber stamped that kind of behavior when they did nothing all summer long.
Thanks, Jim.
Matter of fact, the lawmaker that actually said that is now our vice president, which is really sad.
Thanks, Jim. We're up against the clock here, so we want to hear Anita Kumar's response to other violence in the country.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I've heard that argument several times now, and I can just say that, you know, when asked, law enforcement and officials say that they're investigating every single every single thing and that they will be looking further. But I haven't heard about any other, you know, officials that have been, you know, that are going to be charged or investigated. That's a great way to end, because that's going to be something that the President Trump's people say today. They're going to say, look at all these other people, including Democrats, that made comments. And they didn't incite violence and they weren't prosecuted or charged. So I think that'll be something we see today.
Well, Anita Kumar, we will be following all of the reporting at Politico this afternoon and in the days to come. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. Stay tuned. You can hear live NPR coverage of the Senate impeachment trial starting at 11 p.m. over on the NPR News and Music Network. Up next is news. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Molly Stentz. The right to vote is often considered one of the defining features of American democracy, one of our most sacred responsibilities as citizens. Wisconsin voters adopted our Constitution 173 years ago this month, paving the way for Wisconsin to become a state. Our Constitution says all men are born equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights. But despite that declaration, in 1848, when Wisconsin became a state, that did not mean everyone could participate or vote. That was reserved for those who were white, male, and over 21, with some exceptions. It took nearly 20 years and a Supreme Court case to change this. To allow black men to vote, it would take several more decades before women of any color could vote. How did this come to be? What forces shaped the building of our state? And how much do you remember from your fourth grade trips to the Wisconsin state capitol? We're learning some Wisconsin history this morning, and you can join us. 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. With us is Christy Clark Pujara, an associate professor of history in the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. Good morning, Christy.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Nice to talk to you this morning. Well, I want to start with the Constitution and 1848. Now, the Constitution that voters adopted then wasn't the first draft, and in fact was pretty radically different than an earlier draft that was proposed. Can you start us there with what that looked like, that process of forming our Constitution?
Absolutely. So Wisconsin was supposed to become a state in 1846. You could apply for statehood if your territory had amassed some 60,000 people. That was like the threshold. And after the lead rush in the Wisconsin territory, there was enough people to apply for statehood. And so Wisconsin was up for statehood in 1846, convened a state constitution. And a couple of things really tanked that first constitution. One of them was a referendum that was attached to the 1846 constitution that required an immediate vote on black male suffrage. That was deemed too radical. And when we get to the 1848 Constitution, black men are explicitly banned from participating in the electorate.
Now, what changed in those 2 years?
I don't think much changed. I think that the referendum was always going to be a long shot. And I think it was always going to be a long shot because, like white Americans throughout the nation, white Wisconsinites understood citizenship and whiteness to be one and the same. They understood black people to be outside of the nation and not a part of the nation. And that's just not my opinion. It's in the history before the state constitution convention convenes. In the Wisconsin territory, we have prominent citizens who are holding people in bondage for several years, holding black people as slaves in bondage in the region where slavery is not supposed to exist. And so it's not really surprising that the white population in Wisconsin sees black people as lesser than and not part of the electorate.
So what kind of rights did African Americans have at the time?
They didn't. They were not recognized as citizens of the United States. We tend to think about the experiences of black people in this period. And so let's say, you know, from the Revolutionary War through the American Civil War, really simplistically, like they were either enslaved in the American South or they were free in the North. And that technically was true, although slavery falls apart in the North really slowly and haphazardly. And just to give you an example of that, the state of Rhode Island didn't abolish slavery until 1848. The state of New York didn't until 1827. New Jersey never does. But the bulk of black people in the northern states and in some Midwestern territories are free, but they are people who do not lack who do not have access to liberty. They're not voting. They don't sit on juries. They are banned from the militia. They attend segregated schools. They attend segregated churches. It's a Jim Crow society. We tend to associate that term with the South, and it came into being in post-Civil War America. But the northern states and territories functioned in the way that the Jim Crow South is going to function 150 years later. So black people are free, but they do not have liberty. And in places like Wisconsin during the territorial period, they weren't even free, despite the ban on slavery in the Northwest Territory. Slavery was functioning as an institution because no one was enforcing it, and it was accepted among the white population there.
That's right. So you have territorial ordinances banning it. You have the Constitution coming into effect, also saying that slavery is not legal in Wisconsin. Yet, how much longer did it persist in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to take a longer view of this. There's a long history of race-based slaveholding before Wisconsin is ever Wisconsin, right? And so you have people of African descent that are held in bondage in what becomes Wisconsin during the French territorial period in the 1720s, right? And then you get a larger number of enslaved people in the region when people like John Rountree and Henry Dodge and George Jones bring enslaved people into the area. These are some of the founding fathers of the Wisconsin territory. And some of them are from places like Missouri, where they were holding people in lifelong, perpetual race-based bondage. They bring those people with them to the territories where the ban on slaveholding is not enforced. Historians, I'd say, for the past, you know, 10, 15 years have really been doing a deep dive into the practice of slaveholding in the Midwest. And what we found is that the ban on slavery in the Northwest Territories wasn't worth the paper it was written on. You have people being held in bondage at military forts, and those people were actually being supported by the federal government. Meaning, if you were a military officer who was stationed somewhere like Fort Crawford, you would be paid an allowance to have either a servant or a slave serve you and your family. So it was the practice. Now, are we talking about lots of people holding lots of people in bondage? No. I'm talking about hundreds of people, sometimes thousands of people being held in bondage. But what is clear is that it wasn't shocking, it wasn't scandalous, and it wasn't contested until statehood became evident. And once statehood becomes evident, you see the manumission of people who were never supposed to be held in bondage. And it's a weird thing to sit in an archive in a place like UW-Plattsville and read manumission papers, right? These freedom papers of people who were never supposed to be held in bondage in this region. To read suits of of black people who sue for their freedom because they know they're not supposed to be held in bondage in this place. So it's really interesting, but it's also really telling about, you know, there's the law and then there's the practice.
Right. It reminds me why we have the Juneteenth holiday and how long it took for the country to wrestle with this question. Now, you mentioned Henry Dodge, and I'm curious to know what we know about his practices. The territorial governor, who you mentioned, was a slave owner.
Well, you know, most people in Wisconsin, you know, I have kids that are in elementary school now, they're going to learn about Henry Dodge or see, a park, something, a pavilion named after him. But what we don't hear
city.
Is about, yeah, what we don't hear is about Toby, Tom, Lear, Jim, and Joe, who he brought and held illegally in bondage for 11 years in these territories. Right, who were enslaved here from 1827 until 1842. And they built his fortune. Right, there are reports that, you know, these enslaved people were bringing up 2,000 pounds of lead a day. He was making tens of thousands of dollars off their labor, and they did not benefit. Mm. When they're emancipated, they have to pay. He pays a bond on them, which again is confounding because this institution is not supposed to exist in the territories. But these are incredibly liberty-loving, resilient people who, some of them, go ahead and establish Pleasant Ridge, which becomes this free black homestead outside of Lancaster, Wisconsin, where black families find a place to be free, right? And black people can test their bondage. You have someone like Paul Jones, who sues George W. Jones for his freedom, and he sues him for an exact amount of wages, meaning this is someone who was keeping track of what he thought he was owed, and he knew he wasn't supposed to be held in bondage as a free person in the territories. He loses his case and is emancipated a few years later. But that kind of action tells us about the active endeavor it is to hold somebody in bondage, especially people who know they're not supposed to be held in bondage and who are contesting that illegal practice.
We're speaking with Christy Clark Pujara, history professor in the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. What questions do you have about early Wisconsin history? Did you learn this in the fourth grade? Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Molly Stentz. We're examining some Wisconsin history this hour. Do you know the name Ezekiel Gillespie? It was his actions, his desire to vote in Wisconsin back in 1865 that led to a lawsuit granting voting rights to black men. It paved the way for a more inclusive state. How much did you learn about this in school? You can join us in the conversation. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're speaking with UW-Madison history professor Christy Clark Pujara and taking your calls. Christy, what do we know about Ezekiel Gillespie?
We know quite a bit about Ezekiel Gillespie. We know that he was most likely born in bondage. We know that he bought his freedom from his enslaver, who was also most likely his father. We know that he migrated to the Midwest in search of freedom, like free black people throughout the nation. There were some 60,000 free black people that migrate into what we now call the Midwest, and they are free and they are looking for a place to live with liberty. And he first is in Indiana, and he ends up coming to Wisconsin, like many free black folks from places like Indiana after the fugitive slave law is passed. And Black people become even more apprehensive and less secure in their freedom. They're trying to get closer and closer to Canada if they need to make a run for it to protect themselves and their families. He was a family man. He had a total of 11 children. Two were adopted. He lost two wives, so he was widowed twice. He was left to raise young children on his own, which he did with great dedication. He was an entrepreneur. He sold groceries and foodstuffs in downtown Milwaukee and advertised his foodstuffs for sale in the paper that was edited by Sherman Booth, who was also a white abolitionist lawyer. He works as a porter for the railway company, becomes a very valued employee. And while he's doing all of that, he's also civically involved. Black people in Wisconsin, free Black people in Wisconsin, because when the state is founded in 1848, it is founded as a free state, and there are no more enslaved people of African descent. But this free population is very aware of their marginalization, and they begin to organize early on to strategize about how they get access to the ballot box. There are, you know, several referendums that, you know, fail. And Ezekiel Gillespie, along with other Black men, do things like show up to their voting places, right? These tax-paying men, and ask for the right to vote. And
what happened? What happened when he did try to vote? And that was 1865.
Yeah, that wasn't the first time he tried to vote. That was the first time he tried to vote and took Sherman Booth with him so he could witness him being turned away so he could then file suit. Right. So they're turned away. They're turned away. They're saying, you're Black. You can't vote. You don't have the right to vote in this state. And it's, you can just imagine how infuriating that must be, because Black people by this point in American history, many are 10 generations deep. The vast majority of Black Americans today trace their ancestry back to the colonial period. Right. And so Ezekiel Gillespie is being denied the right to vote as a many generations deep American. And he's standing next to white immigrants who have been in the country maybe just a few years, because you didn't even need to be a citizen to vote in the state of Wisconsin. You just needed to be a white man over 21 who had lived here a year. And if you weren't a citizen and a white man, you just had to declare an intention. Right. That's how conflated whiteness and citizenship were in early Wisconsin. And you can imagine someone like Ezekiel Gillespie, that's many generations deep, right, being denied the right to vote in a place where he pays taxes in a state that declares itself free, right? And so he sues for his freedom. It works its way through the courts rather quickly, which is an indication that the court was looking to take up a case like this. And the Supreme Court rules in his favor. And they rule in his favor not because there's a shift in thinking about Black men and their access to the ballot box, whether they're worthy or not, whether they should have the right or not. The court rules on a technicality. In 1849, so just after, a year after the 1848 Constitution is ratified and put in place, the Republican Party gets a referendum on Black male suffrage on the ballot. But the vast majority of white men, and it's only white men voting, right, don't vote on the measure. Let me look at my numbers. So 5,200 approve, 4,075 say no, but about 32,000 don't vote on it at all. And the State Board of Canvassers takes those abstention votes and counts them as no votes and says Black men can't vote. And the 1866 Supreme Court case says that what the Board of Canvassers did in 1849 was wrong, that they should have never considered the abstentions as no votes,
so,
and only counted the votes cast.
So everyone who did not vote in that election was automatically considered a no vote, to be against suffrage.
Yes. Right? And the thing is, there are two more referendums after that. And in those referendums, the vast majority of white men vote on them,
and they vote no, about 60%.
So the
Supreme Court rules what happened in 1849 was wrong, and so those other referendums don't even count, including the one that happened in 1865, which also was a no by 60%, right? That none of those count because what happened in 1849 was technically wrong.
But it took almost two decades for the courts to hear that challenge.
Yes.
And then...
And Black people are organizing. They're meeting at churches. They're talking about this. They're attending, you know, political conventions in places like Chicago because this is an issue for free Black people throughout the North and the Midwest. How do we get the rights of citizenship?
We're speaking with Christy Clark-Bujara, history professor of African American Studies Department at UW-Madison, taking your calls, 1-800-642-1234. So, Christy, this Supreme Court case in Wisconsin's history after these decades establishes Black male suffrage, but it takes us several more decades to achieve women's suffrage. What happened over that period of time?
So women's suffrage in Wisconsin is like women's suffrage throughout most of the rest of the country. So women are organizing here. I have come across no evidence of any kind of interracial cooperation. What I have come across are white women using Black men's access to the ballot box to argue for themselves. They say things like, even Black men are allowed to vote and we're not, how horrible. Mm-hmm. And so they actually make a racist argument about how they should be allowed to vote because Black men can vote in the state.
Wow.
And, you know, women don't gain the right to vote in Wisconsin until the, you know, the 19th Amendment is passed, but there is no, you know, cooperation between Black and white women and that was pretty true throughout the country. Most white suffragettes separated themselves from Black women who, too, through the National Association of Colored Women, are also fighting for the right to vote. And there were very prominent Black suffragists, but we rarely get to know them or talk about them. And so it's important to remember that voting has always been contested in this space. And I think that that speaks to contemporary moments when we think about who has access to the ballot box now, why we have voter ID laws, what those are intended to do. Voting has always been something that has been raced, right? It's been sexed, and it's been contested.
So fascinating. Christy Clark-Bujara, thank you so much for joining us this morning and giving us this history.
Thank you for having me.
Christy Clark-Pujara is a history professor in the Afro-American Studies Department at UW-Madison. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show.